A school shooting in Georgia brings the gun control debate back to the forefront of American politics.
We have to end this epidemic of gun violence in our country once and for all.
If you take away guns, can't do it, because people need the guns for protection.
Plus, the U.S. has more military aid for Ukraine.
So I'm pleased to say that President Biden will announce today an additional $250 million security assistance package for Ukraine.
And later, a look at the Forum for China-Africa Cooperation, the reasons why migrants are showing up in Latvia, and an obsolete, harmful tradition is still hurting many African girls. Today is Friday, September 6th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Israeli forces pulled out of the Palestinian city of Jenin on Friday, leaving a mass of damaged buildings and infrastructure. It followed one of the biggest security operations in the occupied West Bank in months. That's Sabrine Abu Kamel. She's a Jenin resident. She says this time it is total destruction. Nothing is left as it was. They destroyed the whole house, even the essentials. Nothing is left. Thousands of residents were displaced from their homes during the nine-day operation, during which troops fought running gun battles with Palestinian fighters from Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and Fatah. Elsewhere in the West Bank on Friday, a Turkish-American citizen taking part in a protest against settlement expansion in the occupied West Bank died of her wounds after being shot in the head by Israeli troops. The Israeli Defense Forces released a statement on Telegram saying in part, "During security forces activity adjacent to the area of Betia, forces responded with fire towards a main instigator of violent activity. The IDF is looking into reports that a foreign national was killed as a result of shots fired in the area. The details of the incident and the circumstances in which she was hit are under review." In the U.S., a shooting at a Georgia high school on Wednesday was a stark reminder that firearms kill more Americans per capita than in any other large, high-income country, this according to health experts. Vice President Kamala Harris wants stricter gun regulation. Her opponent, former President Donald Trump, pledges to roll back gun restrictions. VOA's Veronica Beldaris Iglesias explains.
A shooting at the Appalachian High School in Winder, Georgia on Wednesday left several people killed and others injured. Vice President and Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris reflected on the incident during a campaign stop in New Hampshire.
We have to end this epidemic of gun violence in our country once and for all. You know, it doesn't have to be this way.
The topic of gun violence in the United States featured prominently in this year's Democratic National Convention. Harris laid out her priorities on the issue early on in her campaign.
When we win in November, we are finally going to pass universal background checks, red flag laws, and an assault weapons ban.
Harris says she seeks reasonable gun safety measures and is, quote, not trying to take everybody's guns away. The president of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, Chris Brown, trusts Harris will deliver. Brown was interviewed via Skype.
Candidate Harris and Vice President Harris have been very, very clear that gun violence, the number one killer of American kids, is a problem that needs a multi-level approach to solve it. We need better policy.
Former President Donald Trump reacted to the Georgia shooting with a post on his Truth social media platform. He expressed his support for the victims and called the shooter a, quote, sick and deranged monster. Conservatives often advocate for gun rights, but this year's Republican National Convention didn't prioritize the narrative. The event took place in July, just 2 days after Trump, their presidential nominee, was targeted in an assassination attempt. The experience did not change his stance on Americans' access to guns.
If you take away guns, can't do it, because people need the guns for protection.
Trump stood with gun owners when he was president and has promised to roll back restrictions enacted by the Biden administration. Pro-gun rights groups say if gun owners turn out to vote in November, they could tilt the scale to their favor in battleground states. Alan Gottlieb, executive vice president of the Second Amendment Foundation via Skype.
To take back the White House so we have an executive branch of government that isn't infringing on gun rights. And in congressional districts, strengthening gun rights in the House of Representatives and getting control of the United States Senate.
Gottlieb notes, however, that gun rights haven't historically topped the economy or immigration on the list of voters' concerns. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Washington pledged more aid for Kyiv at the U.S.-hosted gathering of Ukraine's allies at Ramstein Air Base in Germany on Friday.
So I'm pleased to say that President Biden will announce today an additional $250 million security assistance package for Ukraine. It will surge more capabilities to meet Ukraine's evolving requirements, and we'll deliver them at the speed of war.
That's Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. At the same meeting, Ukrainian President Zelensky urged Western allies to allow Kyiv to use long-range weapons to strike inside Russian territory. However, Austin's remarks appeared more focused on the broader effort to sustain Ukraine's campaign to repel Russian forces from its own territory. The announcement comes at a high-risk moment for Ukraine, who's advancing into Russia's Kursk region, even as Russian forces are threatening the eastern Ukrainian city of Pokrovsk. As the fighting continues, many in Kyiv, Washington, Brussels, and Moscow are asking, what might the recent reshuffling of Ukraine's government mean for the war effort? And will recent right-wing political victories in Germany have any bearing on European aid to Kyiv? For more, I'm joined by Volodymyr Dubovik, senior fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis and a professor at Odessa National University.
There are big changes, but it's not a complete overhaul. Another thing is that some of those changes were in the air and people expected them to happen, others less so. I think that the intention was manifold by the president. I think he wanted to show that he is in control. And since there are certain negative results within the country in the war situation in procurement of weapons for Ukrainian military, then he needed to do something. And of course, as any leader would, he would rather share the blame with others than just completely become someone who is taking all that blame on himself. Yeah, would it change the war prosecution? I don't think so. Meaning most of the positions that were affected are not necessarily related to the war implementation. So I don't think that this would have a major impact on the war.
So let's talk about that war, if we can. Ukraine is making advances into Russia in Kursk, but at the same time, Russia is bombarding many, many Ukrainian cities. Is the incursion into Kursk worth it? Would Ukraine's resources be better spent defending the cities that are being bombarded?
Well, I think that we would only know the answer, definite answer to this question with time, because right now it's too early with Kursk being happening what for us last month. Give it some time, several months at least, and then we'll see. Because obviously with Kursk, the intention was manifold to actually distract attention from Russian troops to and make them to change or send or rotate some of their troops away from Ukrainian territory into Kursk region, put Putin in an uneasy situation when he's not controlling situation in his own country, and eventually maybe also to have something to trade with, if you want Kursk back, or at least the part of it which Ukraine now controls, give us back our occupied land. We'll see if this will work. So far, it seems like Putin is not budging. He's not necessarily in a rush to negotiate with Ukraine. I think he is very patient. He's okay with part of Kursk not under his control for a while, and he's trying to go, as he did before, straight to trying to control more territory in Ukraine, at least. He is trying to achieve the full control of the Donbas region.
So you're saying that Putin is willing to sacrifice that part of Kursk for more damage, more control in Ukraine?
Yeah, I think temporarily, yes. I think it's more important to him to reach his goals within Ukraine than immediately liberate Kursk. He's okay with some of his citizens suffering. That's never been the major concern for him. As for embarrassment, I think he feels in control. I think he is not necessarily embarrassed or humiliated too much by the Ukrainian Kursk operation, and his position, his regime is still pretty much intact.
So geopolitics are also playing out. A far right-wing party recently won control, won a victory in eastern Germany. And one of their objectives is to give less aid to Ukraine. Does that have Kyiv worried? Is that a trend you see playing out in other parts of Europe as well? Other parts of Germany even?
Well, I'm seeing it. I'm in Germany right now, actually, and I'm monitoring this debate, political and experts-wise. There is a certain threat of assistance from Germany and other countries given to Ukraine being in danger. Their elections wins by AfD, say, in Thuringia or Saxony is not necessarily changing the position of the federal government. But at the same time, yes, there is a discussion like what else can we do? Would more involvement and sending more weapons to Ukraine push Germany towards direct confrontation with Russia? And there is also certain fatigue in the West we feel about Ukraine and Ukraine war. And therefore, some people are asking if Ukraine should maybe sit down after all and accept conditions imposed by Russia. But that would be a disaster. That would be a sort of a invitation to Putin to continue his aggression maybe down the road.
Volodymyr Dubovik is a senior fellow, non-resident senior fellow with the Democratic Resilience Program at the Center for European Policy and a professor at the Odessa National University. Professor, thanks so much for being with us today. Thanks for your analysis.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The China-Africa Cooperation Summit is happening in Beijing. We'll find out what's on the table in a few minutes. But now back to Eastern Europe and another of Russia's neighbors. European Union governments have accused Russia of weaponizing migration by helping illegal migrants cross into the EU. Stokes political tensions in countries like Finland, Poland, and Latvia. Latvian political observers say that this tactic, in part, leads to the gains of the far right-wing parties in European elections. Henry Wilkins has the story from Riga.
Latvia's genteel capital, Riga, belies divisions growing in the country, as they are in Lithuania and Poland. Latvian experts say that is in part due to the weaponization of migration by Russia and its ally, Belarus. Veiko Spilitis is Latvia's former deputy defense minister.
Literally, Russia and Belarus were paying thousands of Iraqis, Syrians, put them on a plane, they landed in Minsk, and then they bused them to the border with Poland, Lithuania, and Latvia, and pushed them through the border.
Migrants began pouring across the borders in 2021. Spilitis says Russia and Belarus had a clear goal. Again, Veiko Spilitis.
To create discussions in Latvian politics in order to bring all kind of populist parties to the power.
Aine Schlesers leads Latvia First, one such party cited by Spilitis. He set it up in 2021 to protest the use of COVID-19 vaccines. Schlesers is also a well-known businessman and politician in Latvia, working on a project to build new apartments and hotels on Riga's waterfront. He has taken strong stance on the economy and immigration.
But we don't need to bring people from third world countries, which will bring crime, which will bring problems to our country. And we see what's going on in Europe in many, many places. I don't want to name now the countries, but you know, all these gangs of immigrants which came and they really increased the rate of crime. It's terrible.
But the relationship between migration and crime is not so simple, says Martin Lang, who has studied the issue. Lang is a researcher at the Leibniz Center for European Economic Research.
it's not always clear that new immigrants, irrespective from which country they come, increase crime. If they're not allowed to work, if they have bad living conditions, then that may increase crime.
Some analysts say that weaponized migration is part of Russia's hybrid war against the West, designed to counter EU centrists and amplify far-right parties in pursuit of Moscow's goals. But some experts say the impact of voters' fears on the rise of populist and far-right parties in Europe may be overblown, and other factors like the impact on foreign policy may be playing a larger role. Kelly M. Greenhill is a visiting associate professor at MIT Center for International Studies.
Does weaponization of migration work as a foreign policy tool? Yes. Can I tell you that politicians feel that they have been very adversely affected by weaponization? Yes. Does the data in the grand scheme of things necessarily suggest that they're right? I'm not sure.
Latvia First claimed a seat in the European Parliament in June, in elections that saw far-right parties making significant gains in Italy, France and Germany. This year, Poland has called out Belarus's use of the tactic, while Finland, which shares a 1,300-kilometre border with Russia, has passed a law in mid-July to prevent it. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Riga, Latvia.
China has pledged $51 billion to African nations at the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation in Beijing. But what is China looking for in return? For some context, I'm joined by Paul Nantulia. He's a research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies.
Beijing is looking for influence. Beijing is looking to consolidate its allies. It has allies in Africa, apart from one country, which is Swaziland, which is the only country that recognizes Taipei. But China wants to consolidate its alliances in Africa. It has upgraded a number of African countries to strategic partners. You know, China has a strategic ranking system within its foreign policy where it ranks countries according to their importance to Chinese objectives.
So what are those Chinese objectives?
So one is to, you know, get alliances. Two, to use Africa as essentially as a foundation for its global objectives. The third objective is to compete, you know, to position China as a preferred partner in military, security, economics, commercial engagement in other fields such as training of African leaders, political parties, you know, that sort of thing.
And negotiations are a two-way street. What are the African countries looking for?
Well, African countries are looking for a number of things, right? They're also looking for global alliances. They are exchanging their diplomatic support because, you know, they do have a lot of diplomatic clout as the largest single voting bloc at the United Nations and other multilateral agencies. They're exchanging that for Chinese support for their own objectives. So that's number one. Number two, they are seeking to diversify their international engagements. Then, of course, they're also looking for infrastructure finance. China has been able to deliver infrastructure quickly. They're also looking for financing instruments. You know, China has flexible financing instruments. You know, creditworthiness is determined not just in terms of forex reserves, but then also in terms of natural resources, right? So, you know, you have the resources. You know, a country like the DRC, for instance, is able to use its resources to secure Chinese finance.
You mentioned the DRC using its natural resources to provide to China in exchange for some of that financing. China has been accused by many analysts, many experts, of using relationships like that essentially to keep other countries in debt and to right. kind of strong arm them into these relationships. Is that what's happening in your estimation?
There's no empirical evidence just by looking at the agreements. If anything, China has written off non-interest loans quite a number of times. The last big debt cancellation that we saw was 17 African countries back in 2022.
So what do you see as a result of the forum that's going on now?
Well, number one, I think we're going to see, we've seen a return to pre-pandemic levels of training. So they're looking at training 6,000 senior military officers in Chinese military academies over the next 3 years. The scholarships for African students, you know, 60 to 70,000 a year. So I think human resource development has been a huge outcome. So I think over the next 3 years, one is going to see the resumption of that forward and backward movement between African professionals, you know, going into China and Chinese professionals going to the African continent to conduct training at different levels. The other big item is, of course, infrastructure. You know, there was a sense that infrastructure was basically going to die out. It hasn't. There's been a commitment by both sides to, they've actually even given a number of 30 infrastructure projects.
Paul Nantulia is a research associate at the Africa Center. Paul, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Even as African countries attend the Forum for China-Africa Cooperation, many of them looking for help to modernize, there's a harmful tradition that goes back centuries that's still hurting some of the continent's women and girls. Reporter Najib Ahmed has the story from Mogadishu, narrated for us today by Anthony Labruto.
This 17-year-old girl lives with her family in a camp for the internally displaced in Mogadishu. She says she is the victim of female genital mutilation, or FGM, a harmful traditional practice defined by the World Health Organization as the partial or total removal of the external female genitalia for non-medical reasons. Since the procedure at 12 years old, she has lived with persistent pain, health problems, and emotional trauma. She chose to speak to VOA anonymously because she fears backlash for speaking about a taboo topic.
I went through a lot of pain, lost a lot of blood because of excessive bleeding, and suffered from recurring infections, which still gives me nightmares. I hope my sisters will not undergo the pain I went through.
FGM persists in Somalia because of the common belief that uncut girls and women are promiscuous, unclean, and physically undesirable. The United Nations says that 98% of Somali girls and women ages 15 to 49 have undergone some form of FGM. Midwife Shamsa Ali Mohammed performed FGM for over 20 years, but now she is one of the many women fighting to end the practice, which she calls circumcision. The United Nations Population Fund, or UNFPA, discourages the use of the term, pointing out that female circumcision is a violation of human rights and a much different procedure from male circumcision. Here's Shamsa Ali Mohammed.
We used to circumcise a lot of girls, but we have now stopped the practice since IFRA Foundation trained us. We now raise awareness against FGM as it hurts women and girls, and many are suffering during labor because of this harmful practice.
IFRA Foundation is a nonprofit working to end FGM in Somalia. Its founder, Somali-Irish social activist IFRA Mohammed, says her organization's engagement have persuaded hundreds of people to pledge not to practice any form of FGM. Another organization, SASA Together, aims to mobilize the community and also aims to abolish FGM. Mohammed Mursal is a UNFPA program specialist who works with SASA Together.
As an organization, we are fighting to eradicate FGM in Somalia by closely working with the government of Somalia, especially the Minister of Family Affairs, to come up with a legal framework that criminalizes FGM in Somalia.
Although the Somali constitution prohibits FGM and describes it as cruel and degrading, no national law exists that criminalizes the practice. Anti-FGM activists say that unless that happens, girls and women will continue to suffer. For Najib Ahmed in Mogadishu, Somalia, Anthony Labruto, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Till next week, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.